Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And, you know, I used to say, as I look out my window, I see no sign whatsoever of improvement. As I check and scan the newspapers, I see no sign whatsoever of improvement. It is not going to get any better. And if you're waiting for it to get better, then I guess, you know, we're going to be disappointed. And it falls under probably that primary definition of insanity. You know, why do we keep doing something expecting different results? Things are not going to get better unless we do something about it. And the reality, as I pointed out, we're letting them get away with all of these sins, all these crimes, and causing all these problems. They're destroying us. They think, oh, well, nah, this is we're evolving. They have no clue that they're just a little spoke in this big wheel turning around that is destined to destroy us. And so, folks, until you start holding public servants accountable, it's that simple. And using petitions, learning how to do this, it's not that hard. And so hopefully you'll actually start seeing people doing it around you, and then you'll actually see great things coming from these people and so forth, and hopefully by that point in time you at least get involved, hopefully. Because, as I always tell people, you know, that sandwich isn't going to eat itself, or whatever it is. You know, that paint isn't going to get up on the wall by itself. We have to do these things. Anywho, with that, welcome back, Sean. Welcome back, Tammy. And we are in Madison's.
Well, according to Hillary Clinton, we're all useful idiots. So.
Well, okay. Well, that was according to Stalin and Lenin. I think Lenin was the one that coined that phrase.
Yeah. That's probably where she got it.
Yeah.
That's exactly where she got it.
So we are in Madison's notes, and we are actually, and I don't know if you remember yesterday when we read that big, long paragraph, a page of Madison talking about property and so forth. The way he was speaking was really third person. I don't know if you noticed that. And so he doesn't really express what he's thinking, what, you know. It's almost like if you're reading that, it says Madison. You go, well, Madison wrote this? These are his notes? Anyway, so that's one of the things I'd mentioned before. He did a pretty good job of trying to keep his biases out. Every once in a while, you could see him. But anyway, as we move forward, now, folks, we're now on page 242, and we're covering Mr. Dickinson, and maybe at the very end of 241. Actually, it's 243, maybe at the very end of 242. But Mr. Dickinson, and this is in the train of, or you know, a conversation going and wandering around on property, republicanism. Actually, they started off talking about debt, accountability, those types of things. So it's an interesting conversation that they're having indeed with Mr. Dickinson. I don't know who left off. Was Tammy the last, or who goes next? Go ahead.
Ladies first.
Okay, Tammy, go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Dickinson was against any recital of qualifications in the Constitution. It was impossible to make a complete one, and a partial one would, by implication, tie up the hands of the legislature from supplying the omissions. The best defense lay in the freeholders who were to elect the legislature. Whilst this source should remain pure, the public interests would be safe. If it ever should be corrupt, no little expedience would repel the danger. He doubted the policy of interweaving into a Republican Constitution veneration for wealth. He had always understood that a veneration for poverty and virtue were the objects of Republican encouragement. It seemed improper that any man of merit should be subjected to disabilities in a republic where merit was understood to form the great title to public trust, honors, and rewards.
Okay, so he's opposed to it. And he thinks that the people, well, if they value virtue, then they will vote for virtuous people. Now, we've heard that's actually said many times, but when we look at, I'll give you a case in point. When you have high standards, then 9 times out of 10, you get, you know, high performers. In the intelligence community for the longest time, you had to be honest. You couldn't own any or owe any debt. You couldn't drink. I mean, your personal behavior, they scrutinized you and they investigated you to that nth degree. And in so doing, the intelligence community was, I'll just say, in working in it, when I first started working, I truly felt in the early 80s that I was working with, you know, the cream of the crop in the military, in the professional arena, because these people were really good people. Now, over time, I started seeing the shifting, and I think I've mentioned this before. Sean, did I not mention this before?
Yes, you have, sir.
Okay, so without really going through it again, when you start lowering your standards, don't be surprised that the quality of people and their ease of corruption and bad behavior becomes prominent, you know, by doing that. And so I do believe that having higher standards is important. And but when it comes to federal offices, it needs to be in the U.S. Constitution. You can't rely upon the states, because certain states will give you good quality people, and then the corrupt states, like Illinois. How long has Illinois been known for corruption in its politics? Let's just talk about Chicago mayors and Illinois governors over the course of, you know, well over a century. Well over a century. They've had different levels of corruption. And other big cities, the same thing. So, and actually, when you look at the politics in America at the turn of the 20th century, in early 1900s, we find that, wow, the party was controlled by these things called party bosses. And you kind of had to get on your knees and kiss the guy's ring, you know, to have an opportunity to run and maybe get his blessing to get elected. That's how things were. I can't believe that that's what these men were talking about, that that's where they wanted us to go. And so, in some ways, I understand that Gary King and these, you know, okay, let's give these guys a chance. Maybe they saw that most of the people that were alive in those days were good people. Are they that naive to think that bad people couldn't exist? Okay, so there was everybody that was alive, and then there was Alexander Hamilton in their day. you know, it's just one of my favorite things to find somebody to pick on them. Anywho, okay, so Alexander Hamilton, out of all the framers, he was the one that got caught in, you know, a long twisted affair of adultery. He got, you know, he had nothing but problems. This guy had problems. And actually, and I don't want to say it because he was a product of his environment. I would just think that it was more of his ambitions. You know, he couldn't settle for what he earned. He had such ambitions, he was willing to cheat, lie, deceive, and do what necessary to obtain what he needed. And so he was driven that way. But anyway, I'll just say that I think that they made a tragic mistake by not creating, you know, this purity of no debt or being the least out of debt and these types of things. That being said, Tammy, go ahead.
Yeah, because, I mean, money nowadays, debt is used as money nowadays, so I don't know how you could get away with that.
Okay. All right. So Mr. Gary then talks about if property be one object of government, provisions for securing it, it cannot be improper. And so Mr. Madison then dives into a little oration on land for him. I mean, I'm surprised that he's doing such large orations, but go ahead, Sean.
Mr. Madison moved to strike out the word landed before the word qualifications. If the proposition should be agreed to, he wished the committee to be at liberty to report the best criterion they could devise. Landed possessions were no certain evidence of real wealth. Many enjoyed them to a great extent who were more in debt than they were worth. The unjust laws of the states had proceeded more from this class of men than any others. It had often happened that men who had acquired landed property on credit got into legislatures with the view of promoting an unjust protection against their creditors. In the next place, if a small quantity of land should be made the standard, it would be no security. If a large one, it would exclude the proper representatives of those classes of citizens who were not landholders. It was politic as well as just that the interests and rights of every class should be duly represented and understood in the public councils. It was a provision everywhere established that the country should be divided into districts and representatives taken from each in order that the legislative assembly might equally understand and sympathize with the rights of the people in every part of the community. It was not less proper that every class of citizen should have an opportunity of making their rights be felt and understood in the public councils. The three principal classes into which our citizens were divisible were the landed, the commercial, and the manufacturing. The second and third class bear as yet a small proportion to the first. The proportion, however, will daily increase. We see in the populous countries in Europe now what we shall be hereafter. These classes understand much less of each other's interests and affairs than men of the same class inhabiting different districts. It is particularly requisite, therefore, that the interests of one or two of them should not be left entirely to the care or the impartiality of the third. This must be the case if landed qualifications should be required. Few of the mercantile and scarcely any of the manufacturing class, choosing whilst they continue in business to turn any part of their stock into landed property. For these reasons, he wished, if it were possible, that some other criterion than the mere possession of land should be devised. He concurred with Mr. Governor Morris in thinking that qualifications in the electors would be much more effectual than in the elected. The former would discriminate between real and ostensible property in the latter. But he was aware of the difficulty of forming any uniform standard that would suit the different circumstances and opinions prevailing in the different states. I have an example, an analogy. If you're a blacksmith, You don't own a lot of land. You just own your shop or maybe mm-hmm. a printing press mm-hmm. operation. Right. You don't own a lot of land, but you might be wealthy and you might be very vital to the community, but true. You're not well landed. You don't have a lot of property.
That's true. Or you could be the guy that's swilling beer or throwing beer around in your saloon. How important is he to those guys? As a matter of fact, you ever heard the term caucus? I know you probably heard the term caucus, right? And so back in their day, when they were done doing the convention, or when they were done with Continental Congress for the day, when they were finished meeting, they would adjourn and they would go and get something to eat. And where did they eat? They ate at a pub. And a pub wasn't like a saloon that we have today, but because they didn't have saloons like we have today. You had to offer a lot so that, it was a very broad section because they didn't have places where the kids could go. As a matter of fact, why would they have a place if a, if a child couldn't go in there? Why would that even be here, if that makes sense? Because they were very family-oriented. And so the what would happen is the cliques and the groups that were working together in Continental Congress, in Congress itself, the House of Representatives and the Senate, when they were done at the end of the day, they would go caucus, go over and have dinner and have some drinks, and while they're drinking and eating, they would continue working their ideas, bouncing things off, and I'm sure that the more they drank, the more wild their ideas got. But nevertheless, these guys did it all the time. But my point is that how important were these pubs or these places that they could gravitate to, because they're away from home, they need to get something to eat, and believe it or not, in enjoying or having a drink of alcohol was one of the key things in their life. It's, you know, they didn't have, you know, these other little gratitude, you know, these things that we find gratitude in, whether it be a game or, you know, whatever. This is, you know, how they could really
watching
let go.
A show.
Yeah, the TV. There you go, TV. Thank you. I mean, what do we do today that consumes a lot of our time? Well, they spent a lot of their time either at work or continuing work at the caucuses, especially those guys that would qualify as the geographic bachelors. The guys that were living in Pennsylvania or in Philadelphia, I'm sure that they just went home to their families. Or they probably went and caucused a little while, and then they went home. Nevertheless. So after anything else you want to point out, Sean?
No, weren't they called taverns? Isn't that where they met?
So they some of them were called, like there was Tun Tavern, where the Marine Corps, but that was another caucus as well. Yes. But they called taverns, pubs. I think they still call them pubs in some places where they serve food and so forth. Yeah, right. But the difference actually today, and I think they started really gravitating when hard liquor really became hard liquor. And that's when people really started doing stupid things. And they said, you know what, I still want to have hard liquor, but maybe we don't want kids to see how stupid Uncle Bob can get. So, you know, they just, you know, you had to be 21 or you had to be of a certain age. Anyway, so after that right there with what Madison basically stated, then Governor Morris seconded the motion on the question for striking out, landed. And then the count went New Hampshire, yes. Massachusetts, yes. Connecticut, yes. New Jersey, yes. Pennsylvania, yes. Delaware, yes. Maryland, no. Virginia, yes. North Carolina, yes. South Carolina, yes. And Georgia, yes. So basically, it really carried almost unanimously. And then on the question in the first part of Colonel Mason's proposition as to qualifications for property citizenship as so amended, New Hampshire, yes. Massachusetts, yes. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, yes. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. Maryland, yes. Virginia, yes. North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. So, I mean, that was 8-3. Still overwhelmingly supported it. And what happened? Anyway. All right. So that's where they went on. And then Mr. Carroll then moved to strike out, quote, having unsettled accounts, close quote. Now, Mr. Gorm kind of piped up. And Tammy, go ahead and read that. And then Sean with Mr. Martin, okay. Go back and forth. Go ahead.
Mr. Gorm seconded the motion, observing that it would put the commercial and manufacturing part of the people on a worse footing than others, as they would be most likely to have dealings with the public.
Okay. Sean, with Mr. Martin.
If these words should be struck out and the remaining words concerning debtors retained, it will be the interest of the latter class to keep their accounts unsettled as long as possible.
Okay. Now, guess who's talking? James Wilson, the guy that's going to become the Supreme Court justice that is sent to debtor's prison. Go ahead, Tammy.
Mr. Wilson was for striking them out. They put too much power in the hands of the auditors, who might combine with rivals in delaying settlements in order to prolong the disqualifications of particular men. We should consider that we are providing a constitution for future generations and not merely for the peculiar circumstances of the moment. The time has been and will again be when the public safety may depend on the voluntary aids of individuals, which will necessarily open accounts with the public, and when such accounts will be a characteristic of patriotism. Besides, a partial enumeration of cases will disable the legislature from disqualifying odious and dangerous characters. Mr. Langdon was for striking out the whole clause for the reason given by Mr. Wilson. So many exclusions, he thought, too, would render the system unacceptable to the people.
Okay. Thank you. And then Mr. Gary, go ahead, Sean.
Mr. Gary, if the arguments used today were to prevail, we might have a legislature composed of public debtors, pensioners, placemen, and contractors. He thought the proposed qualifications would be pleasing to the people. They will be considered as a security against unnecessary or undue burdens being imposed on them. He moved to add pensioners to the disqualified characters, which was negatived.
And if you look, that's how they voted. New Hampshire, no. Massachusetts, yes. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. Maryland said yes. Virginia, no. North Carolina was divided, so basically nothing. And South Carolina and Georgia, well, actually, South Carolina, no, and Georgia, yes. So overwhelmingly, these standards were shot down. And the real question I have is, is this a feign? Is this, you know, this fake of, you know, we want to, you know, we find these other ways being a problem more than that they actually wanted to create, you know, this, the ability to have these types of problems in life where, you know, they didn't want to be held accountable. In other words, when we look today, let's look at Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Does not Section 3 of the 14th Amendment create a hard standard that you are to be removed from office and banned for life if you fail to support the Constitution and do what the Constitution demands? A good case in point on the invasion. Your job, if you're under oath, you are to call for the removal and the repelling of all invaders, not requalifying and reclassifying them as undocumented immigrants, not redefining an invader as an illegal alien. The reason that they didn't maintain that language, invaders, because the Constitution's clear. All invaders are to be repelled. So the first thing they had to do was they had to change that name. Now, during the times of, I think, when we look historically, like with the early 1900s going into the, you know, the First World War and after, you know, there were problems with migrant workers. They would be able to come here and work, but they were supposed to go home, and they didn't. So they had to go grab them and send them back. Were they considered invaders? Actually, technically, no. But they still sent them back because they were here and allowed to come into this country on a temporary basis, not permanent. And then migrant workers came in again. And in the 30s, during and post, as a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, one of the big pushes was during the 30s, because when people needed a job, the migrant workers were out in the fields filling those positions. They said, you know what, we can't get jobs because we got migrant workers out there. So the government basically started repelling them and sending them back and saying, no, we're only going to have Americans in the field. Anyway, so we're going to go into a break, but the real point is that when you look at creating a standard, creating a threshold, and you see people in government or politics, the true consummate politician does not want to be fettered by standards or anything like that. They want to be able to be free to sashay, to slide, to move in ways to awe you, to go, wow, what a compromise that guy gave us. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as I was just appropriately cut off because we had a hard break, politicians only have the ability to compromise over those things enumerated. In other words, they can't come in to work, go to the floor of the legislature and say, we need to create health care, and start pounding an idea of how to get the bill written, passed, and through so that we have health care for everybody. Why? Because in your constitution, in your state constitution, it delineates those things you've delegated for them to be able to do. If they come in and say, we want to do this, and as nice as that looks, oh, like I said, the sachets, it's almost like the, you know, it's Fred Astaire dancing. You know, it's just beautiful the way it just moves. And next thing you know, we've got health care. What a performance. That, as far as I'm concerned, is what political theatrics is all about. And there is no place in our government for political theatrics. As a matter of fact, anybody that starts acting out, we already got the law. It's called Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which means that if you're doing something you don't have the authority to do, you're violating your oath, which means you're to be removed and banned. Now, with the state constitution, Section 3 doesn't apply, but every state should actually have duplicated Section 3. And I think, if I remember correctly, Missouri did, but whether they did it and they meant to do it, and whether they did it and enforced it, the two separate things. The point is that we, the people, need to start demanding. I tell you, the only way out of the mess we're in is to demand compliance to the Constitution and fulfilling their oath of office and starting to remove those people that don't deserve to be there. Okay? So, as we move on and we keep going down the pages and so forth, this is where they kind of talked about the admission of new states and the first branch of the legislature. When you look at how many representatives each state was going to be allocated for representation in Congress. So this part right here is actually... if you go down to July 17th, and this is on page 247, this is where they're still not necessarily working, but you notice it's got these resolved, right? It says seven or six resolved that the national legislature ought to possess the legislative rights vested in Congress. Basically, this is Article 1, to legislate, and also in those which the states are separately incompetent. See, they still have that language, that they can actually put a negative against states, you know, creating laws that they don't want them to do. So they hadn't really pounded through all of these things. But the next line down after the seventh resolution, and the way they put it in, what Madison ended up putting in, it starts off with 16, have no idea why, but the admission of new states is added, that's what I put in, and then 8 resolved that the original formation of the legislature of the United States, the first branch thereof shall consist of 65 members of which, and then they go through New Hampshire shall have 3, blah, 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 blah. And so that should total 65 members. I don't know if anybody did the math or not, but it should total 65 members. They were starting with 65. Interesting, right?
Why is it interesting?
Well, because when you got 13 states, and because they actually talked about, you know, should it be this big? Should it be that big? I've always thought, and I still think to this day, what is appropriate representation? Don't worry about that number. Let's talk about what would be adequate representation back in those days and come down to what it is. Because I think they started off with 40,000 in the Constitution. It came down to 30. I think that had they driven the argument that way, then it would have been settled as to what that number would be. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so I would think, and this is... Folks, when you get involved, if we get the opportunity to start getting involved in taking back your county and your state, you may be in a situation where you're living in a county that just cannot sustain itself. So you may have to, you know, break your county up and merge it with a couple counties or 3 counties to help them get to the size they need so that they can sustain themselves. If you've got a government that can't sustain itself, then you got problems. Seriously, you're going to be a dependent on somebody else funding you, and that doesn't last long. Or the other option is, what happens if all of a sudden somebody's paying for your government? Then they expect that government to do things for them. He who pays the piper calls the tunes. Okay, so let's dive into the actual words that is being stated, because this is being read. Let me go up to, so this is Mr. Butler that is reading and presenting all of this out of the committee. And so who's next? I think it's Tammy. So Tammy, go ahead and read Georgia 3 and then, but the present, that one paragraph right there, because Sean, you can read the 9th resolution underneath that on the next page. Go ahead.
Okay. But as the present situation of the states may probably alter in the number of their inhabitants, the legislature of the United States shall be authorized from time to time to apportion the number of representatives, and in case any of the states shall hereafter be divided or enlarged by addition of territory, or any 2 or more states united, or any new states created within the limits of the United States, the legislature of the United States shall possess authority to regulate the number of representatives in any of the foregoing cases upon the principle of their number of inhabitants according to the provisions hereafter mentioned, namely provided always that representation ought to be proportioned according to direct taxation, and in order to ascertain the alteration in the direct taxation which may be required from time to time by the changes in the relative circumstances of the states.
So, you see what they're doing?
Yes, sir.
So, at this point, they're still talking about admitting states into the union, and they're still talking about the state legislature, or not the state, the federal legislature is still going to control the level of representation. In other words, people hadn't, they hadn't realized how bitter that pill was going to be and the problem that that pill was going to present when these states actually joined and over time said, why is it that we have limited representation? Why are we being limited? Okay, so Sean, go ahead and read the 9th resolution.
9, resolved that a census be taken within 6 years from the first meeting of the legislature of the United States and once within the term of every 10 years afterward of all the inhabitants of the United States in the manner and according to the ratio recommended by Congress in their resolution of April 18, 1783, and that the legislature of the United States shall proportion direct taxation accordingly.
Okay, so they're still using the veiled response to the three-fifths rule. And in other words, things just moving forward. Now, again, let me find out. We're looking at what day is this? This is August 5th. August 5th, they still have new states joining the union that are going to be subjugated. In other words, they're not going to have equal footing. And they still have this idea of the three-fifths rule for representation and so forth. So when we go to Monday and we look at August 6, 1787, the Constitution takes form. And so this right here is where they actually start laying out, right, from August 6th, from resolutions. Now the next byproduct is that they finally created the style that we started seeing and understanding as the Constitution. So they're actually going to go through this. This is August 6th. So there's June, July, almost 3 months, just a week or two shy of 3 months, and with a little over 1 month left. So three-fourths of the convention has almost been done, and let's look at the language as they started proposing things that just still don't sound right, like this, you know, diminishing the sovereignty of states and so forth. So let's go ahead, because I know it's not highlighted, but let's go ahead and look at the language of this so that we can kind of go, because I'm highlighting it now, all is yellow. And I'm doing that just because here it takes form, so let's make a note of what they made the Constitution, or how did they make it out to be, right, if that makes sense. What is here? This is the first time we're taking a look at it. What does it say? So let's go ahead and go back and forth between Article 1, Section 2, Section 3, and so forth and so on. So go ahead, Sean, with the Article 1 and the style shall be, and then Tammy with 2. That way we just kind of, you know, hop
yes,
down
not,
through.
I'm not sure where we're at.
Okay, we're
yeah,
at.
Yeah, I'm lost.
Okay, so we're on page 251. 251, and actually if you go onto 250, and at the, is it on 251? It's on 250, at the very bottom of 250. It says Monday, August 6th, 1787, in convention.
Okay. Oh, okay.
And then it says, this is what I added to this, the Constitution takes form. It says take form, but should say takes. My bad.
Okay.
But then they basically say, Mr. John Francis Mercer from Maryland took his seat. Mr. Rutledge delivered the report of the Committee of Detail. So it's like the style committee, or the Committee of Detail, as follows, a printed copy being at the same time furnished to each member. So now they're receiving the Constitution. And if you notice, what they have there is the preamble. I was just going to bypass that. But if you notice how the preamble, instead of saying we the people, it says we the people, but of the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and they list all of the states, right? And then it goes into do ordain, declare, and establish the following constitution for the government of ourselves and our posterity. So obviously that gets changed by the style committee, but go ahead and let's start off with Article 1, and then the 2 is Section 2, Section 3. So I know it's just one-liners for each of you, but as we get down, it'll start growing. But go ahead.
All right.
Article 1, the style of the government shall be the United States of America.
Article 2, the government shall consist of supreme legislative, executive, and judicial powers.
Number 3, the legislative power shall be vested in a Congress to consist of two separate and distinct bodies of men, a House of Representatives and a Senate, each of which shall in all cases have a negative on the other. The legislature shall meet on the first Monday in December every year.
Article 4, Electors, Section 1, the members of the House of Representatives shall be chosen every second year by the people of the several states comprehended within this union. The qualifications of the electors shall be the same from time to time as those of the electors in the several states of the most numerous branch of their own legislatures.
Okay. Go ahead, Sean.
Oh, I thought you were going to comment on that.
No, go ahead.
Section 2, every member of the House of Representatives shall be of the age of 25 years at least. Shall have been a citizen in the United States for at least 3 years before his election, and shall be at the time of his election a resident of the state in which he shall be chosen.
Section 3, the House of Representatives shall, at its first formation and until the number of citizens and inhabitants shall be taken in the manner herein after described, consist of 65 members, of whom 3 shall be chosen in New Hampshire, 8 in Massachusetts, 1 in Rhode Island and Providence plantations, 5 in Connecticut, 6 in New York, 4 in New Jersey, 8 in Pennsylvania, 1 in Delaware, 6 in Maryland, 10 in Virginia, 5 in North Carolina, 5 in South Carolina, and 3 in Georgia.
Sean, go ahead.
Admission of new states, mm-hmm. Section 4. As the proportions of numbers in different states will alter from time to time, as some of the states may hereafter be divided, as others may be enlarged by addition of territory, as two or more states may be united, as new states will be erected within the limits of the United States, the legislature shall, in each of these cases, regulate the number of representatives by the number of inhabitants, according to the provisions hereinafter made, at the rate of 1 for every 40,000.
Okay, so now I'll pipe in. The legislature shall, this is Congress, dictating how these new states are going to be represented. And they're basically laying it out according to the provisions hereinafter, 1 for every 40,000, but that doesn't mean that they can't diminish them, because they're the ones that are actually regulating, because the language is there, they can do it. Remove that language that the legislature shall, in each of these cases, regulate the number of representatives by the number of inhabitants. And that way they can actually, so in here they may make it 40,000 for the existing states. They may, because it gives them the ability to regulate and to make those changes, the new states would get less. This is why this language changed. Okay, so let's keep going. Section 5.
Section 5, all bills for raising or appropriating money and for fixing the salaries of the officers of government shall originate in the House of Representatives and shall not be altered or amended by the Senate. No money shall be drawn from the public treasury but in pursuance of appropriations that shall originate in the House of Representatives.
The House of Representatives shall have the sole power of impeachment. It shall choose its speaker and other officers.
Section 7, vacancies in the House of Representatives shall be supplied by writs of election from the executive authority of the state in the representation from which it shall happen.
5, Section 1, the Senate of the United States shall be chosen by the legislatures of the several states. Each legislature shall choose 2 members. Vacancies may be supplied by the executive until the next meeting of the legislature. Each member shall have 1 vote.
Section 2, the senators shall be chosen for 6 years, but immediately after the first election they shall be divided by lot into 3 classes, as nearly as may be, numbered 1, 2, and 3. The seats of the members of the first class shall be vacated at the expiration of the second year, of the second class at the expiration of the 4th year, and of the 3rd class at the expiration of the 6th year, and so that a 1/3 part of the members may be chosen every second year.
Section 3. Every member of the Senate shall be of the age of 30 years at least, shall have been a citizen in the United States for at least 4 years before his election, and shall be at the time of his election a resident of the state for which he shall be chosen.
Section 4, the Senate shall choose its own president and other officers.
6, Section 1, the times and places and manner of holding the elections of the members of each house shall be prescribed by the legislature of each state, but their provisions concerning them may at any time be altered by the legislature of the United States.
6, Section 2, the legislature of the United States shall have authority to establish such uniform qualifications of the members of each house with regard to property, as to the said legislature shall seem expedient.
Section 3, in each house, a majority of the members shall constitute a quorum to do business, but a smaller number may adjourn from day to day.
Section 4, each house shall be the judge of the elections, returns, and qualifications of its own members.
Section 5, freedom of speech and debate in the legislature shall not be impeached or questioned in any court or place out of the legislature, and the members of each house shall, in all cases, except treason, felony, and breach of the peace, be privileged from arrest during their attendance at Congress and in going to and returning from it.
Section 6, each house may determine the rules of its proceedings, may punish its members for disorderly behavior, and may expel a member.
Section 7, the House of Representatives and the Senate, when it shall be acting in a legislative capacity, shall keep a journal of their proceedings, and shall from time to time publish them, and the yeas and nays of the members of each house on any question shall at the desire of 1/5 part of the members present be entered on the journal.
Section 8, neither house without the consent of the other shall adjourn for more than 3 days, nor to any other place than that at which the two houses are sitting, but this regulation shall not extend to the Senate when it shall exercise the powers mentioned in the article.
Section 9, the members of each house shall be ineligible to and incapable of holding any office under the authority of the United States during the time for which they shall respectively be elected, and the members of the Senate shall be ineligible to and incapable of holding any such office for 1 year afterward.
Section 10, members of each house shall receive a compensation for their services to be ascertained and paid by the state in which they shall be chosen.
Section 11, the enacting style of the laws of the United States shall be enacted by the Senate and the representatives in Congress assembled.
Section 12, each house shall possess the right of originating bills except in the cases before mentioned.
Section 13, every bill which shall have passed the House of Representatives and the Senate shall, before it become a law, be presented to the President of the United States for his revision. If, upon such revision, he approve of it, he shall signify his approbation by signing it. But if upon such revision it shall appear to him improper for being passed into a law, he shall return it, together with his objection against it, to that house in which it shall have originated, who shall enter the objections at large on their journal and proceed to reconsider the bill. But if after such reconsideration 2/3 of that house shall, notwithstanding the objections of the president, agree to pass it, it shall, together with his objection, be sent to the other house, by which it shall likewise be reconsidered. And if approved by 2/3 of the other house also, it shall become a law. But in all such cases, the votes of both houses shall be determined by yeas and nays, and the names of the persons voting for or against the bill shall be entered on the journal of each house respectively. If any bill shall not be returned by the president within 7 days after it has been presented to him, it shall be a law, unless the legislature, by their adjournment, prevent its return, in which case it shall not be a law.
Number 7, Section 1, the legislature of the United States shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states, to establish a uniform rule of naturalization throughout the United States, to coin money, to regulate the value of foreign coin, to fix a standard of weights and measures, to establish post offices, to borrow money and emit bills on the credit of the United States, to appoint a treasurer by ballot, to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court, to make rules concerning captures on land and water, to declare the law and punishment of piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and the punishment of counterfeiting the coin of the United States and of offenses against the law of nations, to subdue a rebellion in any state on the application of its legislature, to make war, to raise armies, to build and equip fleets, and to call forth the aid of the militia in order to execute the laws of the Union, enforce treaties, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, and to make all laws that shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all the powers invested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof.
Okay, so at this point, because as we look, I'm only interrupting because we're running out of time for reading further. At this point, we can actually see language that is actually scattered around after you see it here. Because, like, these are the powers of Congress, but the powers of Congress, like creating, federal tribunals, inferior tribunals, those types of things, it's actually listed as a power here. But it's then moved over into an Article 3, and technically, some of these things that you look at that are powers are really responsibilities. Like when you look at Congress shall have the power to create rules and laws to make a uniform rule of law for naturalization, whatever that law, whatever the language is that a power? Or is that a responsibility that they have the responsibility of making sure that there is a uniform law? And so when you look at a power, that means that they can go out and create treaties, or they can go out and regulate trade with the Indians. Those are powers. Sometimes we conflate these things. Any questions?
Yeah, I think it's definitely confusing sometimes. Keep those separate.
Well, I think in moving them into the other sections or into other articles really aided in that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Sean, anything?
No, sir.
Okay, and I guess in hearing none and in hearing music, this should actually help. Folks, this is the first time this is really formed. And you can see that they've actually brought in language out of the Articles of Confederation, languages that they've kind of agreed upon and made changes or new things and as they've changed. But again, we're already 3 months, three-fourths is gone, and we're moving forward. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.